Come John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams. And Jimmy, we head to the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline as we're now joined by a very special guest.
We are. It is Shane Matthews. He was a former star quarterback at Florida. He was Steve Spurrier's first starting quarterback at Florida. He was a two-time SEC Player of the Year. He has also coached a lot of high school football. He does sports talk, has done sports talk in Florida, and he also does podcasts. Shane, how are you?
I'm doing well, guys. How are y'all?
Very well. Thank you for taking the time to join us. And I got to get your take on this. Obviously, Alabama's got a heck of a team. Florida played them a wonderful game. But what were your thoughts when Florida was down 21-3 to Alabama in the first quarter?
Well, my thoughts were that's exactly how I thought the game was going to go before it started. I didn't think we had much of a chance. But I tell you what, you got to give our coaching staff and our kids on the team a lot of credit. You know, they could have folded their tents down 21-3 after one quarter and number one team in America in the building. But, man, we stuck to the game plan, and Dan Mullen called a tremendous game. I thought Emory Jones played very well. I think Ty Grantham made some adjustments after the first quarter. We played way too much man covers, and we just couldn't cover them. Mm-hmm. Played a lot of zone, kept it in front of us, and obviously made it a ball game.
I got to get your opinion on this, because a year ago Florida was a pass-happy team. This year, run-oriented, in part because of the quarterback situation. What does that say about Dan Mullen, that he could coach a team that throws a lot one year, runs a lot the next year, and be so productive?
Well, I think Dan's a smart football coach. He puts his players in a position to be successful. But you got to remember, the two quarterbacks that played the last 2 years, Kyle Trask and Felipe Franks, weren't Dan Mullen recruits. And if you look across the roster now, all the quarterbacks on the Florida roster now are Dan Mullen recruits. They're all the same guy. You know, the dual threat, better runners than throwers. And that's what he had at Mississippi State as well, and had with Tebow at Florida. So, you know, Dan's a tremendous football coach, but he did adapt extremely well last year.
Shane, really appreciate your time. Tell me, in the time since you were in Gainesville, what has it been like to, through the years, just get the chance to connect with the several Florida quarterbacks that have followed in your footsteps?
Well, I'm from Mississippi, but I made Gainesville my home base when I started playing pro ball, and I was lucky enough to play 14 years. So I've been in Gainesville pretty much ever since I graduated in 92. Try to stay as close to the program as I can. And, you know, we got some really good quarterbacks that have come through this program, obviously. And I think we got two good ones right now in Emory Jones and Anthony Richardson, the freshman. I guess he's considered a freshman, even though he played last year. I lose track with all the COVID stuff. But, yeah, we got some good guys on this roster. Richardson has a chance to be special on down the road, but I thought Emory played a heck of a ball game against Alabama.
Tell me, going into this matchup, without a doubt, it's no longer what it once was in terms of Tennessee and Florida and the impact that that almost always had on who won the Eastern Division. What do you think there might be in terms of a hangover effect for Florida from that game against Alabama? And what do you think in terms of a Tennessee team that no longer is the circled date on the calendar that it used to be?
Well, it's definitely changed. There's no question about it, because this was the game. It was a tremendous rivalry back in the 90s, especially. But, you know, having a hangover, it could happen. But, you know, hearing the comments of our players after the game about how they want to see Alabama again, I mean, there's a lot of football to be played, and you got to play a lot of games to get to Atlanta. So I think that, you know, it being a night game, I think we'll have a great atmosphere as well. But I think they'll come out and play well. I mean, it's still a big, big SEC game, and anytime Tennessee comes to town, it's a lot of fun.
I guess Shane Matthews, former Florida quarterback. Shane, would you say that the Florida defense is considerably better than it was a year ago?
Yes, and I point to one position and one position mainly, defensive tackles. We went to, I like to joke around, we went to our farm system there in Auburn, Alabama, and we picked up two transfers.
That's right.
To come in and play, and we also got a big transfer at defense tackle from Penn State. So those three guys, going into last year, I watched a couple of scrimmages, and I walked out of those scrimmages going, man, our defensive line just is not SEC caliber. And it actually happened. We struggled there all year long, and I think that had a lot to do with how we played on the back end last year. But this year so far, I mean, we only played three games, But, I mean, heck, we held Alabama to under 100 yards rushing, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. But I think the three big defensive tackles that we got in the transfer portal have definitely helped us be a better defense.
Through the years, I've thought that one of Tennessee's problems on offense against Florida was Tennessee's receivers could not beat press coverage. How good are Florida's cornerbacks or defensive backs in press coverage?
Well, time will tell. We do have a really good one in number five, Kyir Elam. He's a projected All-American. He's legit. The other one's kind of been a rotation of different players. Dan Mullen and Ty Grantham like to rotate a lot of players in the backfield there. So we'll see. You know, Tennessee can put pressure on you. We know they got good athletes on the outside, and with Josh Heupel's system, with the tempo that they play at, they're going to get people open. They're going to move the football. It's just, I think when you play these type of offenses, you got to have that bend but don't break mentality, hoping they get a, you know, you miss a few throws, you get a holding call, guy jumps off sides because of crowd noise, backs them up and puts them in a long yardage situation. But it'll be a test for our guys because we do know Tennessee wants to throw the football.
What do you think in terms of Coach Heupel, the system that he has implemented, and what he hopes to do in building this Tennessee program back to what it used to be?
Well, I don't know Josh at all, but I like what I saw what he did at UCF, and obviously he's coached at a lot of other different places throughout the country. I think he's going to do a good job there. You know, obviously that system puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the defense, as we've seen what they've done at Ole Miss. It's the same exact system. But if you go that fast, you better make some first downs, because you could easily go three and out in less than a minute and put your defense back on the field. So I think he's, you know, if they give him some time, I think he can build it a pretty good program there. You know, and for the conference, it'd be great to have Tennessee back being really, really competitive.
Shane, I thought that Emory Jones played well against Alabama, but I do wonder, do you think that Alabama's offense is better with Emory Jones or Anthony Richardson, or do you think they should try to use both throughout the season?
I think you're going to see both, actually. You know, I coached against Anthony Richardson for 3 years in high school, and what Gator fans have seen is what I saw on tape when he played the lesser talented teams. But when he played the team that I helped coach and another couple of teams in the area that were really good, solid football teams, he struggled. So, now, it's not fair to judge what he did in high school. He's going to be a phenomenal player for us. But Dan Mullen has done a great job with him, because he only asked him, in all his passes that he's thrown, he's only asked him to actually read stuff one time, and that was against South Florida. Mm-hmm. And Dan talked about it in his presser, that he didn't set the protection right. He missed the hot read. He missed the primary read, but he scrambled for 18 yards. And it was a hell of a play. You know, the fans don't see what he missed. Yeah. You can't miss those assignments when you play SEC caliber teams. You will get killed, and you'll put your team in a bind. So, you know, and all the deep balls that he's thrown have been basically just play action boots, not even having to read anything and just launch it. And they've been, you know, schemed up where guys are open. But he's a freak of an athlete. I mean, I think he's a Cam Newton type guy, probably a lot faster than Cam, maybe even a little bigger. But I think it's going to be Emory Jones' team. I think you'll see Anthony play a lot throughout the course of the year. I don't know if he'll play this week because, you know, those hamstrings, you just never know. You can feel great in practice, but as soon as you have to burst one time, you can snap it and you'll be out for the year. So it'll be interesting to see how they play him this week.
He can do backflips with a bad hamstring, can you?
Well, I can't do a backflip on a trampoline, Jimmy, much less, you know. But here's the thing. I snapped my hamstring when I was with the Bears. I had like a 17-yard burst down the sideline against the Minnesota Vikings, and it felt like somebody shot me as I stepped out of bounds. And I tried to play the next week, felt pretty good. But as soon as, you know, the three technique or a defensive end comes free and you have to make that subtle movement and burst and try to get away, that's when it snaps. So, you know, doing the backflips, I don't think it even bothers his hamstring. It's just if he gets in the game and he takes off running and tries to outrun somebody, that's where it could snap on him.
Shane, you played for a handful of teams in the National Football League, and I'm wondering, what was it like to just be a part of those football communities Chicago, Washington, and Buffalo?
Well, it was cold, I can tell you that. You know, I like I said, I was lucky to play 14 years, I think five or six different franchises. Didn't play a whole lot, lasted only because of my mind, not my actually my ability. But it was fun, man. Just, you know, that's a kid's dream to be able to do that and to do it as long as I did. I was very blessed, and, you know, it was great. I enjoyed every city we were in. My kids loved it the most because they were all pretty young when I was playing, and they would go to school in all those cold weather cities until Thanksgiving, and then they would come back to Gainesville after Thanksgiving and finish up. So they got to experience the snow and all that good stuff. But it was fun. Playing 14 years was a long time.
And what was it like to watch your son follow in your footsteps and wear that number 9?
Well, he's retired now. That's what we like to call it. He, after 2 years under Dan Mullen, he hung it up. Unfortunately, he got his mom's height. He's only 5'10". I wish he would have been a lot taller. He was way better than me. He was a 2-time All-State quarterback and just a really good player, but had small offers, very smart kid academically, and Mullen gave him the preferred walk-on, I guess, 3 years ago, and he took it and, you know, got to go to the Orange Bowl and I guess the Cotton Bowl last year. Really liked it, but he's trying to graduate early and building construction, and I'm all for it.
I guess Shane Matthews, a former Florida quarterback. Shane, my memory's not always good, but when Steve Spurrier took over the Gators, you won the quarterback job. And if I recall correctly, I don't know that you were favored to win the job, were you?
No, I was trying to transfer, honestly.
Oh.
But my dad played at Ole Miss with Archie, and my mom was a cheerleader there. But they had a rule that, you know, once you go there, you're going to stay there. So I didn't know who Steve Spurrier was when he got the job. And I watched his last bowl game at Duke, and I was like, man, this is what I did in high school. So I was buried 5th on the depth chart, maybe 6th, depending on which day of the week it was. And, you know, I didn't get in any scrimmages the first 2 weeks of spring ball when he was here in 90. And John Reeves was our tight end coach. I always got sent down to throw to the tight ends. And John Reeves basically went up to Coach Spurrier and said, you need to give this guy a shot. He's extremely accurate and all this kind of stuff. And played pretty well. Then we had to do our spring game because they were tearing up the turf. We had to play over in the Gator Bowl in Jacksonville. And I threw 3 touchdowns there. And after that, Coach Spurrier named me the starter. And I was lucky enough to play for him for 3 years.
What do you think it meant to your college career that you had the chance to play for Steve Spurrier?
Oh, if I hadn't played for him, I'd be selling insurance, or I would have never played in the National Football League. You know, it's all about being given an opportunity and taking advantage of it. And, you know, you see so many players, whether it's in the NFL or college, that they're pretty good players, but for whatever reason, they don't get an opportunity. You know, I tell people now, when I signed my scholarship with Florida, I was 6'2" and a half, 165 pounds. And nobody would recruit me. I would have been like a -1 star coming out of high school, I guess, at that size. But, you know, and I was only 180 pounds when I went to the combine. So I couldn't gain weight. But, you know, it's all about being given an opportunity. There's a lot of good players out there. And, you know, I think y'all, the quarterback that Heupel and they were playing, the hooker kid, I think he's a much better player. I hope they play Joe Milton for the Gator Nation.
Why do you think that? Because he's not accurate?
Yeah, he's got all the measurables, but I'm a guy that maybe it's because I wasn't very big. Maybe my son wasn't very big, but I could care less about arm strength. Give me somebody that can throw completions. That, you know, I try to tell everybody because I do a lot of quarterback camps, and, you know, but the object of playing quarterback is throw completions. You know, it drives me nuts when you have a shallow cross or a curl route and the quarterback zings it in there and it goes off the receiver's hands and everybody's, well, it hit his hands, he should catch it. No. No, it's the quarterback's fault. Throw a catchable football. Accurate, catchable football. That's the goal of playing quarterback. And I just think the hooker kid does that, and I don't think Joe Milton does.
Shane is...
But like I said, I hope Joe Milton plays for our sake.
As Jimmy was talking about you before you came on the show, pointed out how long that you've been coaching in high school, and I'm just wondering, How impressive are the offensive systems, and of course you're a part of this, that are in place in high school at this day and age, and how different is the sport itself from when you were making your way through Mississippi high schools on your way to Florida?
Oh, it's definitely changed. I mean, I never played out of the shotgun. I didn't even play out of the shotgun in college. I used to beg for the shotgun. Spurrier wouldn't. He didn't believe in it. But yeah, it's the offensive systems have changed so much. It's about spreading people out and getting the ball into playmakers' hands in space. That's what you see in college football. If you watch the Florida Alabama game last week, I thought the first quarter, Bill O'Brien did a tremendous job getting his athletes in space against our guys. And I don't care who you are, it's hard to tackle these days. And that's what you see in high school football. Most of the time, you put your best player at quarterback, let him run around and make a play when things break down, and that's kind of where college football is going.
How much do you enjoy being a part of that, having that connection to the game as well as just as developing so many young men?
Oh, I love high school. I love Friday nights. I'm not coaching anymore. I shut it down once my son graduated to do other stuff, but I love calling plays. I love scheming. I feel like I miss my calling because that's something I'm really, really good at. But I always wanted to coach college ball, but I ended up playing too long to get that opportunity. And plus, I wanted to be able to see my kids grow up. These college coaches, mm-hmm. I've coached several of the Florida Gator coaches' kids, the last 10 or 15 years. And I bet they've only seen their kids play like three times on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. And I was like, there is no way I'm missing my kids' games.
Hey, Shane, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it. Thanks for your insight. And hopefully we'll get a chance to visit with you again in the future.
Yes, sir. Anytime. Y'all take care.
Thank you.
You as well.
Shane Matthews, former star quarterback at Florida, fifth or sixth string. I didn't know he was that far down the totem pole. A two-time SEC Player of the Year under Steve Spurrier. So, who says Father Time is undefeated? Tom Brady is fighting that. He's 44 years old. He's got 9 touchdown passes. All other quarterbacks in the history of the NFL, 44 years or older, have 13. He's got 9 this year, and he's probably going to get 40. He's also got 9 straight 30-point-plus games, which are all wins. That's an NFL record. He's the sixth quarterback to have 9 touchdown passes in the first 2 games of a season. And this, to me, is a stark difference. Last year, in the red zone, his completion percentage was 45.2%. This year, 73.3%. Now, what is that? Is that Gronkowski being available and healthy and for the whole year? Is that just being more familiar and comfortable with the system? Is it maybe Mike Evans, who's about 6'5"? That's a huge difference, John, in the completion percentage in the red zone.
Yeah, and I do think that it is sheer and total comfort because I think that you didn't have as much work together on the field going into last season that you did this year. And so I think all of that has been beneficial. The fact that they are coming off of a Super Bowl, they return everybody, all of their starters. I really think that there is such a level of comfort that all of that just comes together and continues to hold them up.
And who's surprised by this? The College Football Playoff Board of Managers, which has the authority to change the playoffs, will not vote next week on a proposed 12-team format, Executive Director Bill Hancock told ESPN. The Board of Managers, which is comprised of 11 presidents and chancellors, will have a video conference rather than an in-person gathering with the commissioners as planned. But they will not vote on expanding to 12 teams. I'm not surprised. I think a lot of them look at what the SEC did, and they're like, we're not opening the door for them to cash in on having 3-4 teams in the college football playoff. So, John, I think it's going to be interesting to see where that one goes.
Yeah, and of course, at the time that everybody was on board with it being 12, it was something they had to do. There was absolutely no doubt about it. They couldn't think of another scenario that would be beneficial to the sport because of everything that was missed last year and trying to make up for all the revenue that was lost. It was a have to. It's amazing how things have changed as quickly and as drastically in terms of the thought process, because I don't think they stumbled over a pile of gold bars that were left over from 2020. I mean, they still need to recoup the revenue that was lost across the landscape because of so many things that just did not happen or didn't happen as planned. And And so I just really think this reveals so much about the process. It is such a stark look that it's all about this until somebody has that ace up their sleeve.
Here's what Bill Hancock said. As the committee moves forward, there remain issues to be discussed.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I can only imagine.
That's right. But this is the chance now for all the brand new members of the Big 12 to show their stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Oh, boy. Interesting. We'll see what happens. But right now, I'm in the corner of they're not going to go from 4 to 12.
Not even close.
Yeah. We'll see.
John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams.
John, Andy Dalton is out for the Chicago Bears. Rookie Justin Fields gets his first start. He goes against Cleveland. How do you think he'll do?
That's a really good question. Did not have the greatest time going against Cincinnati this past weekend when he was pressed into service. Now, a lot of that could be that's kind of being thrown in the deep end. You don't go through the week preparing for the start. You don't go in expecting to play. You go through everything. You make sure you're in on the meetings and everything just in case. But still, it's going to be a stark different approach this week versus last. I think he'll have the chance to perform better, but I also think he's facing a tougher defense. I mean, he will have the entire week to work with the ones, will have the entire week to know what the game plan is, and of course, Matt Nagy will have the entire week to attune the approach and the scheme to what field strengths are compared to Andy Dalton's.
So do you design more runs with Justin Fields? Because right now he is, I think, a better runner than a passer. Or do you think, I don't have many quarterbacks on my roster here?
That's a fair point. I mean, that is the risk-reward because you want to utilize the skills that made him their first-round draft pick.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they were so excited to get him because they didn't expect to get him. But at the same time, if you've run him a lot in the NFL, you have a tendency to get hurt.
Yes, you do.
Granted, I think he's in much better shape in regards to just his build compared to somebody like Robert Griffin III.
Yes.
But also, again, you're talking about this is somebody who's still, I mean, got less than a half a football under his belt at the NFL level.
It may be asking to be smart. Get out of bounds when you can. If you got a first down, slide. Don't risk it. And so maybe that's the approach. Now, Dalton's hurt. Tua Tagovailoa's hurt. He's not going to play for the Raiders. Ben Roethlisberger has a pectoral injury. There have been a number of other injuries. Do you think this has anything to do with the way they changed preseason games, the number of injuries that we've had so far?
It might be all rather than the change of the preseason games and the number of going from 4 down to 3, I think it might be how little activity there was for so many. I think the approach was, I mean, as we talked about with Mike Keith last week, I mean, none of the big four for the Titans on offense played in a single preseason game. And that's Tannehill and Henry and Julio Jones and Brown. But at the same time, he thought that the bigger impact was on the offensive line in terms of an impact somewhere on the offense. So I don't know that it's one-to-one, but I do think that not having what would be the regular buildup to a season after doing it the previous year out of necessity in 2020 because of all that was swirling about, I do think that this has had an impact on the number of injuries we've seen. We head now to the Stanley Fencing Gates Hotline, Jimmy, for a very special guest.
We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Monica LeBron. She's Deputy Athletics Director for Championship Resources at Tennessee. Monica, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're doing fine. Thank you for joining us. And a big announcement from Tennessee earlier today regarding season tickets. And if I were to try to break it down, it looks like what you're trying to do is to make season tickets and football and other sports more affordable for the fans, and yet the donation system to be more equitable. Would that be accurate?
You're absolutely right. More affordable so every volunteer fan can come to the game, and certainly more fair and equitable. We walked into a situation and quite similar to the rest of the SEC schools at one point in time where, hey, I'm sitting on the 50-yard line. I might not have to pay anything for as far as a donation for my season ticket, but the person right next to me is paying $2,500 or $5,000. And so when we say fair and equitable, that's what we mean. So we want to make sure that every donation tied to every seat in each section is equal is fair and equitable. So, yes, you hit the nail on the head.
I know there's a desire for the fans not to panic, but I wonder what the reaction has been so far.
Gosh, excitingly, it's been positive. And so, you know, but really what it comes down to is change can be hard. Change can be different. But we want every single season ticket holder to know we are here to have a conversation with every single person to make sure that we find a situation that's right for them. Each family is going to be different, and that requires that conversation over the phone or in person, which is why we rolled it out now prior to our renewal, which begins in November, to allow people that runway and that opportunity to call the office and to meet with us and to have those conversations so we can put those puzzle pieces together. And if it's whether someone wants to stay in the seat they have or maybe find a seat that suits them better, we want to help them and walk them through it step by step.
Do you think this will lead to more season ticket sales in both football and basketball?
I do. And the reason being is oftentimes people walk up and say, hey, I want a great seat. Well, those seats have been tied up for quite some time, and rightfully so. We have a great product here, and we have some really, really loyal fans and season ticket holders. But those seats have been tied up, and if you're not asking me to pay a donation in those prime seats, then of course I'm going to hang on to them. And so this allows, again, for folks to sit in an area that's comfortable for them financially, but then also will open up some seats so some new season ticket holders can come in and sit in those prime seats as well. So I do. I think it's going to attract new donors, new season ticket holders, but certainly old fans who have been around a long time.
Your background is impressive in terms of just the different experiences you've had already around the Southeastern Conference prior to arriving at Tennessee. And I'm just wondering, considering all the enhancements that we had seen previously at Neyland Stadium, where you had some longtime ticket holders that were moved to other areas and some without the donation were grandfathered in. And then you also had with Thompson Bowling Arena, you had some lifetime contracts that were signed right at the start when they were trying to really get ticket sales going when the facility opened. Have you ever seen as many different categories of season ticket holders and their different quote unquote deals as you've seen it in your short time at Tennessee?
Again, I do think I know the conference pretty well. And so this is familiar as far as my stops in Florida and at Ole Miss and at Georgia. But I guess the difference right now is that I was at Florida from 04 to 08. And in 2005, we sat around a table and said, guys, do you really think that if we separate donations for football and basketball, that people are actually going to support our basketball program? And we decided in 05 to separate it, to rip the Band-Aid off, and to recognize that Florida basketball could stand on its own and that fans would want to pay the donation to support a great product. And then in 06 and 07, we won national championships there. And there's no reason we can't do that here. 16 years later, we've got to modernize how we approach this business. And guess what? That's exactly what it is. We want to make sure we're providing for our student athletes. We're helping them with the resources to compete at the highest level academically and athletically. But we want to be the best in the SEC, which if you're the best in the SEC, chances are you're the best in the country. And it's these modern approaches that we finally have to implement. So, yes, I was a part of these conversations 16 years ago, and I'm really excited for the opportunity to be a part of them today here at Tennessee.
With the sports that are involved in terms of that a donation will be specific for season tickets for those sports, I'm just wondering, would there be the potential that while I fully understand the reason to get rid of the umbrella system that has been in place for so long, would there perhaps be any kind of incentive for somebody who does indeed pick up multiple season tickets for multiple sports as opposed to having to pay maybe the full freight in each location should they want to maybe go across the board?
I think, again, based on the experiences we've all had at each school that we've been at, I think the best model is what we just rolled out, which is have a separate giving model for each sport, each of our five sports that we announced: football, men's basketball, women's basketball, baseball, and softball. And I do think that each of those sports can stand alone, and each of those sports, we owe it to those sports to modernize how we do business and to support them in the resources that we know they can generate.
Our guest, Dr. Monica LeBron, Deputy Athletics Director for Championship Resources at UT. I do want to ask you this. The 2019 men's basketball donations were around $317,000. Do you think those donations will increase significantly?
Absolutely. And again, the reason being is because we had that umbrella model. So if you were giving your donation to football, we were going to count that donation towards basketball, so you didn't have to give an additional donation. You just simply paid the cost of the ticket. So while we were generating revenue from ticket sales, we weren't generating the revenue that we know we can produce on the donation side. And so that, in and of itself, is reason to separate it. I absolutely think, I mean, we can go from $317,000 to upwards of $10, $15, $17 million. So, and again, if we've heard Danny White say we want to have one of the best budgets, biggest budgets in the country to provide for our student athletes. Well, how do we get there? By generating revenue and generating those resources.
My understanding is that not all season tickets in Neyland Stadium or Thompson Bowling Arena will require a donation. Do you know the percentage of that? What percentage will not require donation for football or basketball?
No, I do not have that number yet, and I apologize because you asked us that earlier, and we're working on getting that number for you guys, and we will actually publish that on our website as soon as we figure out what that number is. But there will be a group of tickets, a group of seats, in a ginormous stadium where, again, there is no donation required. And the message there is we want every single Vol fan to feel that they can come to our games. And that will be true in Thompson Bowling Arena as well.
Now, this will affect faculty and staff. My understanding is that instead of paying 50% for their tickets, they're not going to pay 80% of the ticket cost and 100% of the per-seat donation cost. Is that correct?
Correct. And that's, again, why we are on the phones, ready for those incoming calls, ready to meet anyone who wants to talk through it. Faculty and staff are no different. They are customers, and we need to provide them the level of customer service that we're providing all of our outside season ticket holders. So we are willing and ready to walk each faculty and staff member through what a situation that works best for them and their families. So again, if they want to move into the family section to avoid having that donation requirement, then let's find some seats for them in that section. But if they do want to sit in a donor section and they're willing to pay the donation at 100%, then their ticket will be discounted at 80%.
So when will these changes be implemented? Will it be the spring athletic seasons?
So for baseball and softball, those prices that we rolled out today will go into effect for this coming season, the 22 season. But for football, and eventually when we roll out men's and women's basketball pricing, the football renewal starts in November, and that is for next season, the 2022 football season. And then as soon as we have our basketball pricing for men's and women's basketball, we will roll those out so that an account holder, if they do want football and men's basketball or football and women's basketball, that they'll know exactly what they need to owe and pay for the following year. So we want to make sure we get those basketball prices out over the course of the next month or two.
All right, fantastic. Hey, Monica, thank you for joining us. Thank you for explaining that, and good luck in this endeavor.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Jimmy, for having me, and go Vols.
Sure do appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Monica LeBron, Deputy Athletics Director for Championship Resources at the University of Tennessee.
We'll get a break. Coming up, hour number four of Sports Talk, and it starts with your chance to win with a Sports Fix at 6. Stay with us on 99.1, The Sports Animal.